Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
Hello and welcome to Brainwaves on 3CR, 8:55am, digital radio and online at 3cr.org.au. My name's Mark and I'm pleased to bring you the first part of a series of talks delivered at this year's Woodcock Lecture. This year's lecture explored the question of who gets to decide what a good outcome looks like in mental health. Our first speaker is Associate Professor Nev Jones. We hope you find her insights as eye-opening as we do here at Brainwaves.
Thanks, Laura, and what an amazing and charitable welcome we've received this evening. Thank you again, Daniel. Good evening, everyone, and a very warm welcome to you all, or is it a warm welcome? It's a little bit, certainly feeling as if winter has come. But whether you've joined us in person or you're tuning in online, we're so pleased that you could join us for this, again, significant event in our Wellways calendar. I'm Michael Gordon, the Chair of the Board, but it's one of my favourite things to do to open the Woodcock Lecture, which has explored so many issues in the past and broken ground on some of them along the way. But tonight is very special because tonight is our 25th Woodcock Lecture. 25 years of challenge, 25 years of discussion, 25 years of colleagueship around some really challenging issues. But this is a remarkable milestone, and it simply wouldn't have been possible without the extraordinary generosity and vision of the Woodcock family. Their commitment to this event has helped shape the mental health conversation in our country for 25 years, a quarter of a century, and we're very grateful. And every year, the lecture gives us a chance to pause, reflect, and really dig into some of the big questions facing our mental health system. And don't we have some challenges at the moment? Tonight we're exploring something that I think is both simple and profound. Who gets to say what a good outcome looks like? For too long the question has been answered by systems and organisations rather than the people those services are meant to support. And tonight we get to explore what happens when that's flipped around. I'm thrilled to introduce our keynote speaker, Associate Professor Nev Jones, who unfortunately in her travels has had some of her luggage stolen, but nonetheless is wonderfully attired tonight. So Nev, not a great welcome to Melbourne, but we're delighted to have you here. Nev is a community engaged mental health services researcher whose work spans social and political history, community psychology, and medical anthropology, and she obviously has no spare time. Nev is going to walk us through some really practical, real-world examples of what participant-directed outcome measures look like in action, how services have made them work, and what difference it has made for people involved. And I can't wait to hear that. After the keynote, Nev will be joined by two wonderful panellists who are going to bring their own perspectives to the conversation and take your questions. And we love hearing from the audience, so please prepare your questions along the way. Dr. Peggy Brown has spent more than 15 years leading and shaping mental health and healthcare reform in Australia. She has served as CEO of the National Mental Health Commission and was the Commissioner for the Royal Commission into Defence and Veterans Suicide. Peggy brings an incredible wealth of experience, and we're so lucky to have her here tonight. And more importantly, Peggy is also a board member of Wellways and brings great insights to our board, and we're delighted to have Peggy with us tonight as well. Naharika Hiramath is a lived experience partner at Mind, a changemaker whose work focuses on the mental health well-being of multicultural and intersectional communities. Naharika works across lived expertise, service delivery, leadership and governance, and is deeply committed to bridging systemic gaps and driving real organisational and systemic change. Her perspective on culture, identity and community is going to add so much to tonight's conversation. So between Nev and Peggy and Naharika, we have such a rich combination of research, lived experience, policy and practice in the room. And I know the conversation is going to be great. The Woodcock Lecture has always been about ideas. It's about connection, about challenging ourselves, about making sure the people most affected by our mental health systems have a voice. And so as we celebrate 25 years of the lecture, I hope you leave tonight feeling inspired with something you can take back to your own work and your own community. So thank you for being here for this important occasion, and let's get into it. So would you please join me in welcoming our keynote speaker, Associate Professor Nev Jones.
Okay. Well, thank you everyone for coming out tonight. It is extremely rainy. It was invigorating to walk over here. And I will go ahead and dive in. Some of these slides I'm going to move through pretty quickly because there is going to be a lot of additional time for discussion during the panel and through the audience Q&A. All right, so very briefly, to give you guys a little bit more of a sense of my groundedness and the experience that I bring in terms of this specific issue of outcomes measurement. I have actually occupied a variety of roles, and the three I'll speak to here are from the government side. This was after my postdoc. For a period, I was the acting consulting psychologist for the state of California's Mental Health Services Oversight and Accountability Commission. And the role literally sort of centered around overseeing the regulatory processes involved in California's Mental Health Services Act and measurement of outcomes and to some extent also process across the state of California in areas ranging from prevention and early intervention through to other aspects of the community service system. I then moved into an agency leadership role, a very large mental health and social service provider based in San Francisco, and there was directly responsible for developing and implementing measurement strategies across multiple large Bay Area counties. And a lot of that work really involved deep engagement with providers and service users, and sort of the biggest learning for me, I think, was the extent to which often there was not any real buy-in, and the way that people would often respond to, fill out, or complete measures had nothing to do with sort of directly reflecting the truth so much as it was needing to make their program look like it was meeting, you know, kind of performance metrics, and from the service user side had much more often to do with either communicating something that they thought providers wanted to hear and or no buy-in whatsoever and simply just checking boxes down a line on forms. And so I spent a lot of time really reflecting on the sort of the failures of the more conventional ways that we approach measurement. And then I kind of returned to academia after that, have been involved in over the years many, many different projects ranging from sort of capital R research, all of which include process and outcomes measurement in some sense, but also state level evaluation projects where one is really trying to grapple with what is happening in very real world settings without a lot of the additional sort of controls and conditions that you might have in pure forms of research. All right, so I wanted to start this out with kind of an example, a case or case study that sort of brings to life some of the issues. I'll try to move through this relatively quickly. I recently completed a large-scale evaluation of the implementation and impacts of compulsory treatment orders across New York State. So I've been very, very immersed in this issue recently and hence chose it as an example. So very briefly, compulsory treatment orders, if you're not already familiar, are involuntary orders applying to people's service engagement in the community rather than in an inpatient setting. And what people often get through a CTO, I think this is true in Australia as it is in the United States, is access to services that they, in many cases, would not have access to otherwise, whether that is housing or some form of intensive case management or community-based, team-based treatment. There is often, certainly this is true in the U.S. context and in New York specifically here, very little actual rehabilitation happening. And services that, while they may be beneficial in some ways, are often attached to very kind of punitive or carceral structures. So an example is people who are placed in what we call in the States a supervised residential setting are very, very restrictive. They are often switched or moved onto long-acting injectable forms of medication, specifically because this increases the ability of prescribers to control. Right, to control medication intake, whereas more agency and autonomy remain with the individual when they are taking oral medications. And the social reality is sort of the most, I think, kind of bleak aspect of what we see with CTOs in the United States. People are incredibly isolated, often sort of de facto warehoused in these community settings with no real social life, no true community integration to speak of. Now, that's not always the case, right? And part of the point of this entire talk really is that people respond to the same interventions or intervention components in different ways for complex reasons. What tends to get measured very briefly, and I assume that there are a lot of similarities. I did a little bit of homework kind of looking into patient-centered outcomes measurement in Victoria, and I would say that things are probably better on average here than in the States. But I think some of these are cross-cutting issues. What we tend to measure are the kind of data points that you can easily derive from what we call in the States claims data. So things like hospitalization and the number of days spent hospitalized, arrests and various forms of contact with the criminal legal system. So those are probably the two most common. than housing status, but that's often, you know, housed or not, housing placement, nothing particular to the quality of housing or the conditions of the housing in question. Same thing would apply to employment. Provider-rated medication adherence is common because that is a primary goal. And there are typically no person-reported, patient-reported outcome measures of any kind. This is true in New York State. There are none. There's nothing that we could turn to as evaluators to try to understand impacts from the perspective of those, receiving or on the receiving end of CTOs, other than through qualitative interviews. No measurement of people's actual experience of the process itself, critically including the judicial or legal process, meaning procedural due process, and really, you know, kind of the perception that there is fairness and equity in the way that the kind of the court process rolled out and was administered. And no accounting for differences across subgroups of individuals. So it is an incredibly diverse group of individuals, actually, who ends up on CTOs, especially in a state like New York, right? Tremendous social, ethnic, cultural diversity in New York, among many other, you know, aspects of difference that all get kind of buried in an approach to measurement that just looks at, you know, kind of groups as a whole. What we would actually need to track, right, if we really wanted to understand impacts and have the kind of data that we would need to transform things, we would need to understand not just are people making contact with the system, are providers showing up, are appointments happening, but what is the quality of those relationships? What is the, you know, extent of therapeutic alliance? What are the self-motivations and goals of the individual, not those prescriptively set by the system, but set by the individual, including their relationship to medications, right, which is heterogeneous, which is diverse. People are impacted very differently by medications and end up with very different relationships to them. Genuine social connection and kind of a life, right? A meaningful life beyond the kind of the constraints and boundaries of paid clinical services, work, school, and roles that people themselves might actually want. Financial empowerment and financial well-being. This is huge because poverty, as I repeatedly kind of come back to throughout the presentation, is one of the, if not the biggest drivers, right, of outcomes in this space. And yet we very rarely look at how people are actually able to manage on the incredibly low incomes that they are typically kind of trying to operate through. Autonomy, empowerment, and sense of self. I think this is a hugely, hugely important area that is very, very challenging to measure, and we very rarely measure. One of the biggest potential harms of very kind of carceral or coercive services, especially when people are repeatedly over and over exposed to them, is impacts on identity, including social defeat. And internalization, really internalized oppression, and what some kind of traditions within kind of sociology and international development refer to as adaptive preferences, right? Coming to kind of adjust what one expects or anticipates out of the world because all you have ever experienced is oppressive. You know, again, these are areas where, at least in New York State and in the United States in general, there is no measurement happening. And then just to return to procedural justice and people's sense of trust in systems. What is their relationship to systems, and how is that, in fact, impacted in the context of involuntary treatment? Good outcomes vary enormously by individual. So again, the kind of status quo approaches to outcomes measurement tend to assume that good outcomes or benefits are the primary thing that's being measured. If there is in some sense a tension to potential harm, it's only as maybe the inverse or the absence of a benefit rather than acknowledgement of qualitatively different harms and equity and how those are captured. These good outcomes are just assumed to be good for anyone. The system has judged that this is a good outcome. Reduced hospitalizations, which is a very debatable point, right? Hospitalization can mean very different things to different people, but we assume that reducing it is a good thing, and that is universally true. We ignore individual, local, and community contexts that may shape what is or isn't valued or prioritized. And we prioritize quantity over substantive quality, right? So again, housing, yes, no. Employment, yes, no. But we're not looking at the quality of housing, the conditions under which somebody is housed, right? So a punitive group home or supervised residential setting is very, very different, in fact, from somebody autonomously living on their own in a community housing or a social housing situation where there's a lot of agency and intentionality involved. Same thing with employment. One can be working under extremely oppressive circumstances, and when we don't measure the quality of the work, we are missing huge pieces of what matters most to folks who are directly impacted. So again, just to kind of repeat, the shift in question then becomes that we enter measurement, right? Approach measurement, understanding that there is a huge array of ways in which people are impacted from areas as diverse as sort of the material and financial to identity and sense of self to relationship to systems and relationship to others. Outcomes are shaped by individual and local context. They're never just going to be universal or generalizable across diverse settings and groups. And there is a real need to start to shift measurement to understand what works for whom and why, under what circumstances. And I'll talk a lot more about this. And then substantive quality over quantity. All right. So again, I would say that if the goal was in fact, okay, I need to go faster, social recovery, CTOs are really not doing that, right? So here's an example where the potential role of measurement is so important, right? We can't move away from something that we haven't really understood, that we haven't been able to characterize. And yet we are falling very, very short of truly capturing people's experiences in a way that allows us to move forward. Okay. So here I want to kind of shift to suggesting the value and importance of adopting realist approaches. And if you're not kind of familiar with realist evaluation, the sort of really core concepts are that you connect context and mechanisms to outcomes. So outcomes are really just the sort of, end effects that are really driven by underlying mechanisms of action, right? So the underlying processes that are actually doing the work. And for any given intervention, there are typically multiple mechanisms, and those mechanisms can, depending on the individual and depending on the context, drive benefit or harm or everything in between. And the contexts that shape them are equally critical, right? Because if we lose any of these pieces, if we are not understanding context, if we are not understanding and measuring mechanisms as well as outcomes, we're not really understanding what is going on. We are not, in fact, positioning ourselves to intervene, to change things, to shift things. So to use, again, CTOs as an example, most certainly does not involve one mechanism, one outcome, or even a small discrete set of mechanisms and outcomes. And this is already oversimplified in a sense, but a possible benefit pathway, a possible harm pathway, just to illustrate this. So the context of a possible benefit pathway would be that the CTO enables access to resources such as housing that the individual does indeed want, desire, and caring providers or a team of providers who are genuinely and authentically invested in the individual. And that can lead to the mechanism of the order unlocking scarce resources and this engaged caring team. And that then can lead to an outcome of stability and structure that in turn build trust and kind of lay a foundation for somebody to pursue life goals, right? With that sort of support, that structure, basic necessity of access to housing. A possible harm pathway is that you are someone who is placed in a high surveillance residential setting, like I described. You're put on long-acting injectables in a way that feels like it is compromising your bodily integrity. It's not a positive experience. You're subject to random drug testing, which also feels like a loss of control and autonomy. And you are subject to constant threats that you will be rehospitalized for non-compliance. Your relationship to providers may be one in which you experience behavioral enactment only through threat, which is not a positive thing, of course, in general. So the mechanism here is coercion plus enforced high-dose medication that in turn kind of brings about a compliant state. And the outcome is containment, withdrawal, social defeat potentially. All right, so I know I have to be very fast now. So part one is sort of taking seriously the challenges, and then I have some kind of solutions. So obstacles or challenges. One is identifying mechanisms. We have spent a lot of time globally defining and measuring outcomes, but not mechanisms. And so we actually have a lot of work to do, both to truly map out the mechanisms underlying change in any given area for any given intervention, and then to measure them appropriately. Same thing is potentially true, maybe to a lesser extent, of context. Some contextual factors we're better at measuring than others. There's often a lack of buy-in. So I alluded to this in kind of talking about my past work in California. But often there is no real reason for anyone on the front lines, whether they are on the receiving end, carers or family members or frontline providers, to believe that participation in measurement-related activities is going to lead to any real change. And because there is no buy-in, people are not necessarily filling out measures for the reasons that researchers or evaluators might assume that they are. So sometimes it might be, well, I don't want to offend providers who have power over me, so I'm going to say that I'm very satisfied. Even if a measurement process is presented as anonymous, that doesn't mean that somebody believes that it is truly anonymous. And often it is not, in fact, truly anonymous, depending on how data collection works. Social defeat is really critical. So social defeat is both a big picture issue that we have to think about when we're thinking about outcomes in general, and in as much as it directly impacts measurement, right? Because once people have experienced so much societal and social rejection, deprivation, material deprivation, and probably sort of a betrayal of trust within systems, they are gonna, in many cases, come to gradually accept that this is just the way things are, right? This is inevitable, and to maybe even kind of lose what maybe they entered with in terms of critical positionality, critiques of how things are. So therefore, you can, you know, send out satisfaction measures, and it looks like, oh, people are very satisfied with these services, when in fact they have just come to accept very, very suboptimal conditions. limits of conventional measurement. So it's a very, very problematic, right? How we have traditionally developed measures, identified items for measures, and then quote unquote validated them. And we tend to treat a measure, once it is quote unquote psychometrically validated, we can now use it indefinitely, sometimes in any country in the world, without the work really required to fundamentally question whether it still applies, whether a measure developed with adults in the 1980s in fact applies to young adults in 2026, or whether a measure developed in the United States actually applies to individuals in rural Australia. We simply don't question it. We use measures. And that's very problematic and something that we really have to kind of contend with in this space. And then exclusion of those who are most marginalized. This happens with any kind of self-report attempts, right? Because people who feel the most disenfranchised, who are the most disenfranchised, who have dropped out of services, who are quote unquote refusing to interact, are precisely then those who we fail to learn from through measurement efforts. And the same thing happens in participatory processes if we go a layer up. We very, very rarely, for instance, in the US, see anybody in decision-making spaces or participatory processes who have themselves been on CTOs, right? So the more kind of marginalized the group you're talking about, the less likely it is that they have any representation in processes. And that means systemic failures of both participatory process and measurement, and systemic failures that further marginalize those who are already the most marginalized. And even having the right data in and of itself doesn't guarantee that anything is going to change. So that what I think of as the political economy of kind of measurement and systems reform is very complex. There are multiple kinds of power hierarchies, and there's ways that money and financing often de facto dominates what decisions get made, even when we have data that strongly suggests that change needs to happen. So we need to take that very seriously, because it would be sort of a, you know, kind of self-imposed myth to think that just picking the right measures, measures that matter, measures that people with lived experience have selected, right, or co-developed, co-produced, is going to lead to the change. Okay, and then very quickly, some solutions. So measuring mechanisms and context, not just results, aka outcomes. We really need to map out mechanisms and context. If we are implementing any intervention, if we want to look at a specific system of care, we need to understand and look at the diverse mechanisms that may be driving different kinds of outcomes. And if we haven't done that, we are not positioning ourselves as a system, as a program, as a project to really understand what is happening or to ultimately intervene to change it. I think that we cannot pursue quantitative measurement initiatives or projects without the integration of qualitative work. So, for example, really taking seriously the fact that if people are not even filling out measures for the reasons that we think they are not understanding the items in the way that the standardized form of the measure expects them to, the data we're getting doesn't even mean what we think it does. And the only way that we can develop a deeper understanding of what's going on is by talking to people in a deeper qualitative sense. And we never escape from that. It's not a one and done, right? It's an ongoing process of deeper engagement that ensures that we are indeed measuring what we think we are. And then holistic data analysis, I will say very briefly, historically, for large populations, large programs or agencies or implementation efforts, we really haven't had a choice but to rely predominantly on quantitative closed-ended items. Now, with large language models and AI, it is actually possible to do very sophisticated qualitative or open text analysis at scale. It is is entirely possible in ways it was not previously to recontextualize data. And so I think that this is a very promising aspect of AI and large language models, is actually taking seriously a lot more complexity and a lot more of people's actual stories rather than just these very sort of abstracted data points. People defining what matters, right, is very, very important, and this is very individual. So it's not a matter of saying, well, we did a few focus groups in this community and the consensus seemed to be that housing or employment was the most, so now we're just going to measure that. There is too much variation, not only across regions or areas, but in terms of the individual. And there are some different strategies that I will kind of briefly talk about that allow us to, or kind of facilitate this process of looking much more specifically at the individual. So one is goal attainment scaling, and goal attainment scaling is much more difficult and kind of high resource to implement, especially to implement well. But the idea is that each individual identifies what matters to them, what their goal is. Then there is a formalized process of scaling out different steps to make progress towards that goal. And then each point along that trajectory is measured and becomes part of performance monitoring data reporting. So highly individualized, it involves a lot of resources and therefore is subject to sort of corruption or gaming, right, if it's not implemented well. But I just want to kind of briefly mention this. Another example would be measures like the Inspire that allow for, that are simpler than goal attainment scaling, but allow for individualization. So the Inspire, if you're not familiar with it, is two-part. It is framed in recovery terms, and the individual first indicates what aspects of recovery are actually important to them, and then the extent to which their key worker, this was a UK-based measure, so that's the kind of standard terminology there, is actually supporting them with that particular goal, doesn't get scored if it isn't even a goal for the person. Why would somebody be helping you with something that you don't even want to pursue? And that alone is a pretty huge, right, kind of switch or pivot from more traditional measurement in which it's just assumed that everything is sort of equally relevant to everyone. Structural drivers, quickly. So structural drivers are a key part of context that influence the activation or inactivation of mechanisms. But really, they influence absolutely everything about somebody's trajectory, from the way that they may be treated by providers, somebody who is marked as different by race, culture, ethnicity, poverty, class, right? There are influences there and influences on every aspect of what a person can do and be, right, in terms of the resources they have access to. We often make the mistake in kind of clinical circles, clinical contexts, of claiming that our clinical interventions or services are somehow magically going to improve outcomes in the absence of more fundamental efforts to address these underlying drivers. And we hold this out to politicians and policymakers, often thinking that, oh, this will lead to us getting more money, more resources in the mental health sector. And what it does is really provides this, you know, a political alibi for inaction in structural change. And secondly, I think when I'm talking to groups of providers, I'm often get this pushback that, well, that's not our role, that's not what we're trained to do. So of course we just focus on individual level clinical intervention. And I would argue that that is completely wrong. It is every bit our responsibility, even a central responsibility of clinicians, the whole kind of clinical world, to insist, right, insist that until and unless we address structural drivers, everything else we do will only go so far. Somebody living in abject poverty cannot truly, quote unquote, recover, right? And I think a lack of over-promising, right? Over-promising what we can accomplish in the absence of deeper structural change. Honesty. In the absence of a lot of the time, we don't know the answers, we can't solve the thing, we can take steps towards solving the thing, but that is, it's a long-term goal, it's a long-term process. We need to be really honest about this. And I think across the mental health system, there is often an absence of honesty. Prescribers are not honest with patients about the side effects of medications. People in positions of authority in clinical systems are rarely honest about the extent of what they don't know. And I think the amount that we don't know when it comes to mental health far exceeds the number of things that we can claim to have factual or definitive answers to. So honesty is really important, and it's kind of a first step. If we really want to change things, we have to begin from a place of honesty. So, you know, a lot of lip service is paid to lived experience inclusion. What we see is overwhelmingly tokenism and tokenization rather than substantive involvement. We just need to be honest about that. We really do. And if what we're doing doesn't involve truly deep investment, it's potentially harming the cause more than anything. Because adding people to a superficial advisory board when that does not meaningfully transform the decisions made is actually not helping anything, right? So honesty and the hard work that goes into really deeply embedding diverse lived experience stakeholders into processes in ways that are actually going to challenge, change, transform what we do. And one just almost never sees this happen. And then honesty about, you know, again, what I refer to as the political economy of it all. There are complex power relations, there are complex financial motivations, and ways that kind of financing influences almost everything that we end up doing. In fact, in systems, we can't pretend that away, we can't imagine it away. And when we're engaged in processes with multiple stakeholders, right, we need to be honest about what is actually, you know, influencing or impacting decisions potentially in a disproportionate way. And the more that we pretend that it's not there, this is yet another thing that undermines buy-in at even this higher level or trust in these processes at this higher level, because people are brought in, you know, weigh in, express their perspective, their concerns, and then actually the same decision is still made. And, you know, people will either stop coming or stop truly believing that their presence makes any difference. And then how we can address that is really through feedback loops of accountability. We have to make actual concrete material changes to what we're doing based on what we are learning from diverse stakeholders and, you know, centering in this process those most impacted, those most likely to be marginalized in these processes or who have been the most historically. We need to kind of openly acknowledge the problems, again, this honesty, pay attention to the drivers, because if you ask people living in poverty, the extent to which that poverty drives so much about their lives, I have never heard anyone, never met anyone who will not be, you know, very emphatic in articulating how much that is shaping their life, so much more than, you know, even whether they have a compassionate provider or not, whether they have access to services or not. If they can't pay for basic food to sustain themselves, if they run out of money before the end of the month, that is much more fundamental. And if we don't pay central attention to that, we're not really listening to people, and they're not going to trust or believe that we're listening to them. And then we actually make changes, right? And the more that those feedback loops repeat, people who might sort of enter into this feeling deeply distrustful over time are going to start to believe it does make a difference, it does matter that I'm here, or at the level of measurement, you know, I complete these measures honestly, and it actually leads to things changing. And it doesn't lead to punitive consequences, right? So like the PHQ-9 suicide item, for those who are familiar, the most likely consequence in many systems of honestly completing the suicide measure is that you could be involuntarily hospitalized, right? Not helped, but involuntarily detained. So again, the more this repeats and people see the kind of real change happening, the more they are now invested in answering, you know, and responding to kind of questionnaires and survey items in the way that will give us the honest kind of truthful reflection of reality that we need to in turn change things. And I'm slightly over time. I apologize. I only have a couple more slides. The mechanisms, right? The importance of understanding the mechanisms. I just want to kind of come back to this, because this is, again, not traditional measurement. We focus on outcomes and not what is driving them. And if we want to be able to change things, we have to understand what mechanisms are coming into play, especially for complex interventions like CTOs, where so many different things end up bundled together. Access to things that are good, punitive mechanisms that many people would say are bad, systems accountability that may be good but not necessarily justified to tie systems accountability to stripping individuals of their rights and liberty interests. So understanding those mechanisms is really the only path to thinking about what do we change and why about this. All right, and then just last slide. This is just sort of a summary, right? Summary of everything. Measuring the context and mechanisms that actually drive these more meaningful social outcomes, or what sometimes gets referred to as recovery. Understood as complex and multiple, never one thing, never all benefit and no harm. That is almost never the case, even for superficially benign interventions. Building data systems that just refuse this assumption that everyone wants the same things, that we can use universal measures for everyone across national contexts, across regional contexts, across age groups, across ethnic groups. And building out systems in ways that, again, truly center those who are most impacted, and by that I mean who are not benefiting from the status quo, whose views or perspectives are divergent or different in ways that we historically and contemporaneously marginalize and continue to marginalize. That's where we have the most to learn. That's where we have to be pushed the most. All right, thank you, guys. Now panel.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.